Good evening. First of all, Robert, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. And I thank you all for inviting me here. I must admit it's my first trip ever to Jamaica. And I'm really very happy to be here, so thank you very, very much. Obviously, I want to thank very specially my friends from the Museum of Modern Art in New York, long-lasting friends, Barry, Jay, Patty Cisneros. You know, thank you all for being here and for inviting me to be part of this symposium. Well, the first thing is that, you know, I sort of felt a little bit ambassadorial as I received the invitation, sort of being like the one Mexican and there was like one Venezuelan, one from everyone. So I sort of felt I needed to make a case for Mexican architecture. So I guess I have divided my talk basically in two parts. One, I'm gonna just try to go very fast through a very short historic synopsis of what I consider the most important moments of Mexican architectural history, only to try to explain the work that not only me, but me and other friends and members of my own generation are currently doing in Mexico, and I would say in Mexico and in many other Latin American countries that are quite similar within this global context. Well, having said that, you know, the second part, I'm gonna just show you one project. I thought, you know, in my 30 minutes, there wasn't time for more. So I'd rather just concentrate on one project. It happens to be the Guggenheim that I was just described. So that's basically what it's gonna be. I hope I don't take much more of the 30 minutes that you have allocated to me. I'll try to stay quite on time. Well, and then the second thing is that, as you may probably know, I was born, raised, started my career, and still practice basically out of Mexico City, which is not a Caribbean condition. You know, I'm probably very far from being anything in the Caribbean. Nevertheless, I am sure there are many cultural resemblances, so I would also hope that you would be able to sort of locate that in that condition. Being in the Caribbean, which may be part of Latin America, although Jamaica may not, I don't have to explain where Mexico is. When I speak in other countries, including the States, I need to do that. I guess here you all know where Mexico is. So I'm gonna skip that one. Now, I will refer, obviously, to the architecture, not of Mexico. Mexico is a very diverse country, both geographically and culturally. And therefore, I need to refer, if I speak about Mexico, I need to refer to Mexico City, which on its own is a very unique and fantastic phenomenon. Mexico City, as you all know, is one of the largest cities in the world, one of the most complex cities in the world. I do think it's one of the greatest cities in the world. And this is only to locate Mexico City, which is as you also know, it's a very high altitude city located in within the mountains of Mexico City, of Mexico, in a very high plateau. So therefore, not even the weather resembles to anything here. Mexico City is a city that has grown incredibly in within the last 100 years. This diagram just shows you what was Mexico City in 1900, what's Mexico City in the year 2000. And that only explains what the challenges of a city like Mexico City could be. And I think that Mexico City certainly has become one of the most important laboratories for contemporary urban architecture or urbanity or urbanism. And I think it's quite important to carefully look at what's happened in Mexico City and what will be happening with Mexico City. And I'm very proud to say that I'm completely invested in Mexico City and I'm working very, very closely to that city, which is really the city of my heart. And I see a city with great future, fantastic future. As you probably know, Mexico City was founded on a lake. It was a very small island that started growing artificially until that happens, of course, when the Spaniards came at the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century. And they found some amazing architecture that had been being built for basically thousands of years, very sophisticated conditions, although very, very different in principles. Nevertheless, very complex in its relationship, especially to the landscape and to the universe at large, which were probably great. And all of this I only say because I really believe that each one of those stages has somehow built on the understanding of contemporary Mexican architecture and the future of architecture. Spanish eventually came to the main important cities, to the most important cities, and built a new city in every one of them on top of the existing city. No architects came, fortunately, at the time, but a lot of missionaries that found enormous capacity of labor and enormous opportunities of materials. And with that, they created really some very surprising and marvelous cities that became what we have been able to understand as colonial architecture in Mexico. The 16th century was probably the century that has seen the most construction ever in Mexico City, besides, of course, the 20th century. The missionaries came with enormous hope, and they started building those fantastic convents, dash churches, dash fortresses around the whole country. Some of the most amazing and unique examples of colonial architecture, of all of the different different scales, different locations, different responses to the uniqueness of its culture have come out or came out of the effort of these first missionaries and the labor they have found there. Of course, they always needed to invent a new religion and a new society and a new way of dealing with space that had never even imagined before, that was very different to the traditions of European space. It was obviously very different, not only in climatological conditions or material conditions, but was very different in cultural understanding of space that created a completely different scale and a completely different vocabulary that was only that can only be found in America. And this is really, I think, where the architecture of the New World, the architecture of the Americas, really starts. That came into a variety of buildings throughout the 300 years of Spanish colony, which is basically the same for all of our countries. And it went from being first from religious architecture, eventually to other kinds of more civic architecture, into eventually palatial architecture of all sorts, creating some amazing and very unique buildings. Through the time, you know, and at the end, of course, many influences were coming from Europe. The exchange with Europe and with the Far East, as we all know, was quite intense. In Mexico, we ended up having one of the most beautiful and exquisite Baroque periods that we can, although we don't have too many examples of that, we have some incredibly beautiful examples, both of Baroque public space and Baroque architecture. In this case, what I'm showing you is the Capilla del Pocito, which is an extension of the Shrine of Guadalupe in Mexico City, which is a beautiful piece of that. Then independence came, a year of a huge eclecticism, a century of huge eclecticism within the 19th century. Enormous, I would say, many influences from all of the different European styles. We should say that also wasn't a very clear time for architecture and the arts in Europe as well. And eventually came the big moment of emancipation in our countries, marked in Mexico basically by what we call the revolution. And with the revolution, we jumped immediately into the 20th century, and with that, the start of modernism in our country and in our city. I don't have to tell you that I completely believe that the only worth tradition of our architecture is the tradition of modernism. but that's another topic. Still, the beginning of the 20th century was, I would say, occupied by a vast variety of very eclectic examples. Like, for example, here, the Palacio Postal in La Ciudad de Mexico, or the very well-known Palacio de Bellas Artes, that were both built at the beginning of the 20th century, when, I would say, a very strong draw to modernism and the international style was already rooted and was quite discussed in the international forums. Nevertheless, I would say that the less civic buildings of the time that started emerging in our city were cities that were representing the same trends of modernism. What we have ended up being able to call Art Deco and Art Nouveau, at the beginning of the century, the first decades of the century, still constitute some of the most important components of the texture of our city. Needless to say, and as you all know, there were some amazing examples of good modernism in Mexico. You may all be very aware of the work of Juan O'Gorman, who was doing these incredibly purist modern designs and buildings, basically simultaneously as Corbusier or Bruno Taut were working in Europe, doing their own very similar things. Although with using, in this case, very clear, I would say, well, not Mexican, but labor of the Americas, and very clear, a very clear materiality that was part of the traditions of our countries and of our cultures. At the time, there were, of course, the big architects that had an enormous influence in Latin America. Le Corbusier was working in Brazil, and was working, this is all the first half of the 20th century. Le Corbusier sort of pushing from Brazil and from Argentina. Mies himself had just arrived to the United States, and as a matter of fact, we have a Mies building in Mexico City. Unfortunately, I couldn't find that slide. I'll have to ask Luis to give me that slide for the next talk. And of course, Gropius was having an enormous influence, and we had the luck, I would say, to be able to host Hannes Meyer, who moved to Mexico City, and I would say had a very important influence. If he didn't get to build much or nothing, he had a very much and strong influence, academic and intellectual influence in our city. After that, a big group of amazing modern architects emerged in Mexico. Some are better known than others, but there's of course, this happens simultaneously to the Second World War, and not much investment is happening in Europe. It's after the recession in the United States. Big capitals are moving to Latin America and being formed in Latin America. And there's also great knowledge and great sophistications in the societies of the early second part of the 20th century. Some examples in Mexico City is the work of Mario Pani, earlier than that of Regón Santa Cilia, and our whole group of different architects that eventually created one of the most fantastic collections of modern architecture in Mexico City, which is the campus of the National University, which was a collaborative effort led in the early 50s. The master plan was done again by Mario Pani, and then each one of the different architects and artists of the time created one piece there. And I really think it's really one of the most important, I wouldn't say Latin American, but global collections of modern architecture. Of course, I cannot leave out our big hero. Everybody, you know, every country needs a big hero. We found it in Luis Barragán, you know, one of the great poets of architecture that drew drew most of his big, strong influences, both from Mexican modernism and from his various trips to the Mediterranean, and ended up developing a vocabulary that, of course, has influenced not only the architecture of my city, of our country, of our, many of our countries, but I would say has had a very important global architecture in the world. Simultaneously, there was another very important character that arrived to Mexico, sort of fleeing Europe of the Second World War, which was Matias Geddes, an artist, a sculptor that collaborated enormously both with architects and with urban planners, and ended up being a very influential, I would say, detonator of modernism, both for the arts and for architecture in our country. And I'm sorry I'm going very fast, but you know, I wish I could stop much, have more time in each one of them. Nevertheless, in the 60s or 70s, and this is basically, you know, I started going to school in the 70s, this is what the panorama of my city was. Basically, there were, I would say, three sort of big paths in Mexico City. Was best represented by the architecture of people like Ricardo Legorreta, which was sort of trying to emulate or derive his work from the work from what we would call a local regionalism, like regional influences, and trying to understand this mixture that had sort of come or being able to be depicted by Barragán, but also from the very regional opportunities that he could find in popular architecture. There was a very strong condition that still persists. All of those still persist, they're still there, which was basically two architects that worked together for a very long time and ended up doing their own work, which were Teodoro González de León and Abraham Zabludowski, that were drawing their vocabulary basically from an international brutalism that was that had been happening again in the 60s and 70s around the world. They have strongly still trying to relate it with some of the specially scale conditions of pre-Columbian architecture, but it's really a direct a derivative of international brutalism, in a very unique condition, represented probably uniquely by Agustín Hernández, which was being drawn basically from the Japanese metabolists, and that was sort of the ambience or the soup that I had to start swimming, me and the members of my generation, when we started working, or when we were in school and started working in our countries. Needless to say, as we went to school, if you didn't follow one of these lines, there was no opportunity or chance for you. Nevertheless, and then, I will try to use one building of mine only, one project of mine, in order to be able to represent what I think is happening today, and what I think maybe many of the opportunities of the future of at least of our country's architecture, maybe of many of these countries' architecture, it could be. Also, you know, I purposely picked it up because it was an international competition that we won for Guadalajara. It's a very important museum. Having been invited by MoMA, by the Museum of Modern Art, I thought it was perfectly okay to show a Guggenheim project, if that's okay with you. Obviously, it's been on the news yesterday and today, that name, on a very protagonic condition. So I think it's very opportuno to be able to present that today. And I'm going to jump immediately into this project. Guadalajara is the second largest city in Mexico. It's the second largest city in population, I would say, not in economic growth or in any other condition, but it's the second largest city in Mexico. And it's a city that, for a variety of reasons, has been trying to, I would say, reinvent itself and find a new path or a new future for itself. And I would say that little by little has been able to draw a lot of cultural attention and cultural institutions are now growing roots and being very interested in the city of Guadalajara. It's very well connected to the world, has a very good tourist infrastructure, a very good transportation infrastructure. And obviously, it's a city that draws the attention of the Guggenheim. When the Guggenheim decided that amongst their, I would say, expansion projects or globalization projects, they wanted to have a museum in Latin America. We probably all know, or many of you know, that at the time they were working on another project in Brazil that unfortunately fell apart for some political, for political reasons in Brazil. And therefore, they decided that they needed to look for a different location in Latin America. What the Guggenheim had decided at the time, and I think it's still sort of valid now, or it was valid until 2 days ago, but it will change for the better, I'm sure, was that they wanted to establish, besides the museum they already have, they wanted to establish a venue, one in the Far East, one in the Middle East, and one in Latin America. And now they're also, well, they had already done an association with the Hermitage, but still they're now looking into Eastern Europe as well. They obviously came to Mexico and selected this site, one, because the city of Guadalajara was quite attractive to them, secondly, because it's an amazingly incredible site that I will describe to you in a moment. Needless to say, the opportunity, or also the commitment to build a Guggenheim is huge. And this is part, of course, of the interest of a competition like that. So far, the Guggenheim has built two ground-up buildings that we all are very aware of. One is, obviously, the Frank Lloyd Wright's building on Central Park in New York City. The second one is the museum in Bilbao by Frank Gehry. And in my humble opinion, two of the most important buildings and definitive buildings of 20th century architecture. So the challenge when you get invited to do a competition like that is huge, because obviously what they expect is nothing less than that, but also nothing that could ever even resemble anything that they have always done. And it's a big opportunity to take a big risk and a big leap into the future. The site that has been chosen is located at the northern edge of Guadalajara. Guadalajara is a very, very flat city, if any of you know it. Very few taller buildings. A 10-story building would be a very tall building, and I don't think there are more than 20 of those in the whole city. This site is located at the northern edge of the city. At the north, the city is suddenly caught by this amazing ravine, and the city just finishes up right there. And in front of it, this is the views that you all get. It's all nature. It's that beautiful 800-meter ravine, and then all nature in front of that. And there's no way to get there, so it's very difficult that it will ever get developed. This is the view towards the ravine from the site. And this is the view exactly at the same spot, turning around 180 degrees. And here, as you see, is again the grid of the city, the grid of the colonial city that has grown up, and the very low, even, texture of the architecture of Guadalajara, as we look back into the center of the city. The city, as any other colonial Spanish city, was built on this axis, north, south, east, west, and our site is located exactly at the tip of the northern axis. Certain sort of like issues started to come up to our mind and we started working in this very interesting competition. One is that if the Guggenheim really wanted to create a global destination, as they always describe their buildings, it was very important to create within the texture of the city a beacon that would not only recognize the institution, but that would recognize the place in the city that was not very well known by the inhabitants of the city. Although this is an amazing site, it's sad to say that not even many people in Guadalajara know that site. It's a place that not many people even go there. So it was very important to be able to define how from anywhere in the city we could sort of be able to create a beacon that would identify and mark a place in within the skyline of Guadalajara. And obviously immediately the seduction of building something tall started emerging immediately. And not only something tall, but something full of light and something that would be quite striking within that existing texture. Having said that, this little park is the site that the city is giving to the institution to build, to the new foundation to build this new institution. Our next issue is that that's a public park. And obviously, as you can imagine, most of those surrounding areas are not where the wealthiest people in Guadalajara live, but the contrary. And as you can see, there's very little open space there. And that's obviously a park that it's very, very highly used by the inhabitants of this area in all conditions, for sports, for entertainment, and also just for contemplation. We could find there many, many people that would just go there for a stroll, for a picnic, or just to sit down and look at the fantastic views. So our second impulse is that although we understood that this is a project that would bring enormous development to the area, and in the middle range future would be great for the area and for the city of Guadalajara, as it has been for other cities, especially Bilbao. We also sort of thought that there was some, I would say, a little issue of injustice, of taking away to the next generation, to this immediate generation of children, of teenagers, their only park, and then which would be completely occupied by a new institution where people would have to eventually have to pay to get into those grounds, you know, enormous amounts. As we know, you know, the international museums are not inexpensive to visit, and it would create a very weird condition in within the site. So what we decided as well is that we wanted to give back immediately a park, in as large a park as we could, to the inhabitants of the area and of Guadalajara at large. We started working, and of course, as we started understanding that the tower made a lot of sense, because the smaller plan, the taller tower, the more we were giving back as a park. And then suddenly, as we started working with it, we understood that we realized that we had a scheme where we would only be using 5% of the park. And that's when we thought, well, if we can give back 95% of the park, we can give up 100% of the park. And the whole scheme is based on giving back immediately, that would be the first thing to be built, 100% of a new park, all of the views go immediately back to the city, and then the new institution is floating above all of that and does not interfere with the visits of anyone. We went through a very long, I'm sorry, I already used my 30 minutes. I'm going to use 10 more if you let me. Nobody's up here. Okay, thank you. Thank you, sorry, thank you very much. We went into trying to understand and learning what contemporary art museums were doing at the time. And we tried to define what we call a typology of spaces that basically were keen to the different curators at a variety of the different museums. We obviously used first the existing Guggenheim Museum, which is obviously an immediate reference. We also were looking at the two museums that at the time were being designed in other places of the world that by now they have, they're not going to happen. One was the Guggenheim in Rio de Janeiro, the other one was the Guggenheim in Taichung, in the country of Taiwan. And then we went to look at the most important museums of that scale and of that theme at the time, like the Museum of Modern Art that was about to open or had just opened, the Tate, the Center Pompidou. And then we tried to make a vocabulary that, taken from all of those spaces, would be able to suit the new Guggenheim Guadalajara. Basically, what we found, and it came, this came over and over and over and over, after Bilbao, which I personally consider Bilbao one of the greatest buildings and one of the greatest museums of the world, but after Bilbao we have seen, I would say, a big range of expressionist buildings that were, according to the curators, were less and less taking care of the relationship within the art that was going to be shown there. And more curators were sort of trying to step up aside or step apart from that expressionist sort of vocabulary of museums at the time. Many books came out in 5, 6, 7 years ago about this theme. And basically, the more we spoke with curators, with directors, with museum administration, the word big box is what they want. They said, what we need are big boxes. We need big boxes to show a new condition. And suddenly we started realizing that a big box could become a bigger box, or the biggest box, or the taller box, or the longer box, as long as there were basically those big, I would say, ethereal, clean, white spaces that would allow, again, art to be a very protagonic condition. And never, and this, of course, is for the gallery. That doesn't apply to many of the other conditions of the museums themselves. Therefore, we designed what we called a kit of parts, where we would bring together all of those varieties of boxes and be able to understand and play with them and be able to provide every one of those cases. I should say that the hardest one was the last one there to your right, which is a derivative of what it's called in Bilbao, the Fish Gallery, that I'm sure many of you know now occupied a fantastic collection of serras. But many of the still of the curators and directors still thought that having a gallery like that was a huge asset in the museum. These are sort of three of the schemes that we explored as we were working on the competition and that we thought had an opportunity. The first one was discarded because obviously it would completely block the access to the barranca, to the ravine. There were all these sort of like collections of different boxes. The second one that could give us a more, I would say, varied or expressionist condition also couldn't satisfy us for basically the same reasons and the faster occupation of the land. I should say that all of our other competitors went in this direction, basically. And then we decided, and little by little, we started getting more and more confident that just stacking up together all of those different galleries in their different configurations would give us a possibility that probably hadn't been explored before. And this is basically what allowed us to come to the final scheme. The one gallery that we couldn't fit in there was the Fish Gallery, and therefore we decided to bury it, or partially bury it, according to the topography. We went through a variety of iterations in articulations of that kit of parts. Eventually we decided we'll just take one, whichever one could be, didn't matter for the competition, as what was important for them was just to express an idea and then we would have the opportunity to work with the actual team to develop exactly what would be better suited. The next move was to understand that a museum like that is basically, or many times can be understood, like a series of museums or a collection of museums that sometimes work independently and sometimes work together, depending on the different exhibits that may be shown at a place like that. And then we decided to create a variety or a vocabulary of galleries or museums and start separating them and creating spaces that we ended up calling the interstitial spaces of the museum. That probably is what eventually brought the strongest addition to the scheme, as we understood that those were, and here are represented by the reds, that those were not only opportunities of meeting people, opportunities of encounter, a variety of opportunities of social and cultural interaction, but were also fantastic of opportunities for the museum for commissioning art of a scale and of a character that really had not found many opportunities in other museums of the world. If we relate perhaps to the meaning of modern art, only because Patty, Jay, you know, you're all here, it would be, you know, that fabulous space, or what I consider that fabulous space in the center of the museum today, or if we see at the Tate Gallery, the gallery of the machines that has been able to now commission or detonate expressions of art that couldn't easily find spaces within this kind of institutions. In this project, we had like 7 or 8 of those spaces, which became very, very interesting, of course, for our jury. Well, this is a collective of all of the different conditions. This is the site plan. I would say that eventually what we ended up proposing, this is the tower of the museum. This is an extension of Avenida de la Independencia. It's a sloping promenade or public space that goes under the museum into a new public platform that has been added to the park, and everything again becomes an art park that would also be able to house a big art or land art conditions, together with the ravine that we had got the third big gallery of the museum, as you know, that now contemporary is moving very much toward that condition. This bar is also a floating sort of big, very large truss that basically holds up the tower and allows for a bridge that will allow people to go under it. I will not stop in going through all of the plans. These are basically all of the different facades of the building. Here in the last one, you can see looking at the building from the ravine, where you would see the truss, the tower, the open space, and this is the fish gallery or the large gallery that pokes up at this corner as it encounters a drop in the natural topography. As two sections of the scheme, here's the sloping public space, the sloping promenade, the open vestibule to the museum under the tower. There's a way of getting down to the 1500 data platform overhanging on the ravine that would allow to have a completely different experience of that natural condition, but also become a viewing platform for very, very large land art that would be commissioned in within the ravine. This is the truss that basically holds up the tower, attached again with some very important tension cables. And then the different smaller museums and galleries that occur, some very fragmented, some very open, in different iterations and articulations. This is a section in the opposite direction. Some models of the competition entry. Well, this is just a reference, of course, to the axiality of pre-Columbian architecture, as we were describing why our museum had been positioned right at center with the south-north axis of the city of Guadalajara, marking that point at the end of the city. A view as we approached the sunken plaza or the tilted plaza, and how people would discover again a very clear window into nature again, and have opportunities to come up with a park that remains elevated towards this plaza. It was very important to sort of slope and see the plaza in order to create that open and public condition, but also in order to create a space that would be a defined urban situation, new situation in the city. This is the approach, again, to the big window, entrance to shops, restaurants, and the actual entrance to the museum. Only after people would enter here would have to pay their ticket. Everything else is open for everyone that would want to visit it. I would say here we see the truss that supports the tower, and this is where the restaurant of the museum happens. Farther down are the offices, the educational center, the library, etc., etc. This is a view looking back from the viewing platform, from the cantilever platform into the ravine. Some views of the gallery, in this case, the big, large fish gallery, or I keep on calling it the fish gallery only because of Gary's, with an opening into the view again at the end, where the topography had already dropped, and a recognition of the truss. The opening of the roof is really the truss of that supports the rest of the building. What the boxes are, this is the same space utilized in different conditions with different scales of expressions of art, but very simple, clean boxes that could be completely controlled by curators, directors, and whatnot. And as I said before, the opportunity of what we call the interstitial spaces that would happen at least six times during the building, that would divide the different galleries from one to another, and would also bring up opportunities of commissioning different conditions of art, and at the same time, that really don't find space in other locations, and at the same time become sort of like semi-public spaces. This is a different one of those spaces with different opportunities. And this is the gallery, the big gallery, a huge gallery at the top of the tower that is just one huge cube of 40 by 40 by 40, or actually 39, that could also change from being completely open to the sky to completely darkened for other kind of exhibits. The building is surrounded sort of by a double layer of skins that within the two layers is where all of the main circulations occur and connect, spirally the whole building. This is not, of course, the only way of moving through the building. That would allow people to relate always to the surroundings of the museum, both to the natural conditions and to the urban conditions of the new institution. Needless to say, this scheme plays a very important sustainable role within the building, as only the boxes that I described before are completely controlled by powered mechanics, I would say. And then everything else is just a buffer that takes the residuous either hot air or cold air from those spaces. Those spaces need to be done that way, because if not, there's no way to comply with international standards for museums. And this is a view of the tower from the city of Guadalajara in within its surrounding context. In the tower, again, at the ravine, as it would be sort of like uncomfortably standing there. And with that, I thank you very much.